My name is Sally Steenland, and I'm the director of the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. This week, Richard Murdoch, who's the Republican Senate candidate from Indiana, said in a debate that pregnancies resulting from rape are a gift from God and that victims should be denied abortion care. This past summer, Todd Akin, who's the Republican Senate candidate from Missouri, said that women don't get pregnant from rape because, and here I'm quoting him, if it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down. It's clear that we need to do a lot of public education about violence against women, what it is, and say that very clearly. With me today is Reverend Victoria Ferguson. She's a chaplain at the Women's Resource Center to End Domestic Violence in Atlanta, Georgia. Victoria works with survivors of domestic and intimate partner violence, as well as with those who commit the acts. She has a lot to say on these issues that were in the headlines this week and a lot more. So welcome, Victoria. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So let's get right to it and start with the Richard Murdoch comments. And you issued a response to that. And so I'm going to read back to you part of what you said. And I'm quoting you here. This type of theology further victimizes women who've had to endure a horrendous act. Murdoch's views have nothing to do with God, but everything to do with acquiring a dangerous, controlling grip on the lives and decisions of women. So let me ask you, how rare do you think Murdoch's view is? And are there variations of views of women who get raped or assaulted? You know, they asked for it or the man couldn't help himself. Tell us what's going on here in your view.
Sure. You know, I wish that I could say that these views were more rare, but unfortunately they really aren't. I mean, even from what you've mentioned in the first part of our interview and conversation with from Richard Murdoch to Todd Akin and just even other opposition we've seen for women getting access to healthcare and reproductive rights and of course, you know, the legitimate rape statement, we see that it's not that rare. I think the thing that's shocking to me is what's rare is how he said that God intends for this act to happen. That's something I haven't heard recently, but the idea and notion of women not being able to have access to abortions or just legal and safe abortions and to proper health care and that this act is something that God intended to do or that's something that we don't see is or rather not the last part, but that women's bodies are a commodity, that's something that we see quite often. That's something that's becoming more and more in the voices of leaders and faith leaders in particular, and conservative rather faith leaders. So we're seeing more of that. But it's something that makes me very cautious because it's something that is so damaging to the lives of women and something that's so damaging to those who are victims of rape and survivors of rape. And are there variations? Absolutely. There are several variations. There are ways in which this notion is kind of watered down, if you will, with saying that women ask for it or, you know, that's just a man. There are times in which survivors of rape, some of the first questions that someone will say is, you know, well, she shouldn't have been there. Well, what was she doing there? Well, why was she there? And, you know, well, we have to, and we have to see that men are, you know, that's something that a man does, or you have to, you know, just watch yourself or guard yourself, but there's no accountability to men there. So there are variations of it. This notion that a woman's body is a commodity, that women really should not have access and make choices for themselves, and that they bring upon violent acts to themselves is something that, unfortunately, is not so new and not very rare.
And it sounds like, you know, although those views may not be rare, they're not true and they don't reflect reality. So I'm going to ask you a little bit about what the reality is, because you have worked in churches, you've worked in prisons and hospitals, and you've worked in advocacy centers with women who are survivors of rape and domestic violence. So, you know, tell us some of their stories and what's really going on.
Sure. Well, the reality is, and to answer your first part, is that it really is not, these views and these extreme views are not about God. They're truly about control. It's about power and control. And that's really the basis of all abuse and all violence, is that it's about power and control in one person or entity, including power over another person or group of people. That's what it's really about. In my own experience as a chaplain and as a faith leader and working with prisons and churches and advocacy centers, what I've seen, what I've heard are, of course, personal stories of violence, but what I've also seen are the way in which our society has perpetrated violence against women, that it's been cycles of violence, that it's coming from more than one space. Well, when I first started this work as a chaplain in 2005, I worked and served at a women's prison called Metro State Women's Prison here in Atlanta, and I remember some of the first stories I heard, and each woman that I spoke with over that five-month period, at some point disclose some type of sexual abuse or violence that they face, whether it was as a child, whether it was as a teenager, or even as an adult from their intimate partner. But it was amazing to me to hear that each woman there had experienced, that I spoke with, had experienced some type of sexual abuse and just the impact that it's had on their lives. And then I've also seen, as working in with the Safe House where I work now with the Women's Resource Center, the impact that violence has had on women, from just sharing their own stories, but then also one of the things that's standing out to me right now, there's a woman that I worked with not long ago, actually when I first got to the center, she has five children, and they're each about a year apart. And she talked with me about how she faced so much criticism from peers, from even family members, from just coworkers. With she was pregnancy after pregnancy after pregnancy, and she expressed to me that she never wanted to have that many children in such a short amount of time. That the reason behind her pregnancies was because her husband had raped her repeatedly, and that she had no choice to use contraception. So when I hear those stories, when I hear those things, I think about just the impact that of course rape and sexual assault has on a woman, but then also how our society can just re-victimize a woman, and how often that happens. So, you know, and in addition to that, so those are some of the realities, but I also hear stories of success and stories of women who have come to our safe house, who are connected to a network of a support system of advocates, legal advocates, of house advocates that work at our safe house, and even just counselors and therapists that have really been able to help to contribute to their independence, to be women that are truly independent and that are able to live in a healthier lifestyle that does not involve violence and that is away from the violent situation that they came from. So there are so many stories that I've heard, and in faith communities, you know, the stories are no different. When I do a lot of community education events, I hear stories of congregants and parishioners in different faith communities that talk about similar experiences of rape, how they've come to church and they didn't receive or they didn't get the help that they needed initially. And so there's, in so many manners, there are ways in which, as I've mentioned, women and survivors of violence are victimized again by society after also being victimized by their partner in their households.
So for you as a chaplain, given the work that you do, what is the link for you between faith and domestic violence and reproductive justice? You're a leader in our faith and reproductive justice leadership here at CAP.
Yeah.
You work in domestic violence, which isn't always associated with religion or faith, but yet you bring that lens, you bring that perspective, you bring that identity to that work. So how does it all connect for you?
Well, the way that it connects is that faith communities are places that, in our faith communities in particular, are places that shape our consciousness, they shape our understanding, they shape our beliefs, and they contribute to, you know, to our mores, what we consider to be right and wrong. And so there are very powerful places that are a strong part of an individual's consciousness, especially those who are raised in churches or synagogues and masjids. The messages and words that they hear are reinforced, of course, in their day-to-day acts and in their behavior. And so that plays a huge part in regards to domestic violence and reproductive justice. When, you know, there are messages coming from a community of faith that are damaging or that perpetuate violence, that only really plays into and, of course, perpetuates domestic violence and the lack thereof of reproductive justice. So there can be very damaging messages, yet at the same time, there can be messages and there can the creation, if you will, of a very liberating message that can be the exact opposite of that. So the power that can come from what's preached, what's spoken about, what's taught in a community of faith truly resonates within communities because, it, like I said, it shapes what we believe. And so that's where I see there being such a strong link, that if more communities of faith preach more of a liberating message and more of a message of inclusion and gender equality and the importance of each person, that it would truly make a shift in violence, in abuse, in domestic violence that's perpetuated, and in denying access and denying reproductive justice to women.
And I think you're right. I mean, faith communities in many ways are on the front lines of these issues. They're the first responders. They know families and women very well because of who's in their congregation. So I want to ask you for sort of follow up on that in terms of faith communities and domestic violence. And I want to ask you about Kindred Moxie, which is this initiative that you've started that actually works to help faith communities both prevent and then respond to domestic violence. So what is that? What's Kindred Moxie?
Kindred Moxie is an initiative that I started, as you said, to work directly with faith communities. And Kindred Moxie means connecting together to face difficulty with spirit, courage, and love. And so that's exactly the work that I do with communities of faith. As being an advocate in working to end domestic violence, what we always work towards is the coordinated community response, which means different parts, different entities, different sectors in the community all working together to end this issue. That means that there's a collective voice, there's a collective response that will not tolerate or accept any type of domestic violence, and that's what we work towards. And so Kindred Moxie in particular works to engage communities of faith to be more involved and be more a part of this response. And so there's six aims that I have in working with each faith community. At this point I work as a consultant with different communities. So it's interfaith, so not just, and I'm a Baptist minister, but I work with synagogues and have done a little bit of work with a masjid and looking to, but primarily I have been working in Christian context. But what I do is initially just sit down with different leaders and I ask them, and I do an assessment with them. I'll find out, what things have you done in the past in response to domestic violence? Have you talked about it? How have you as a leader or a pastor or a rabbi, how have you responded to any type of domestic violence or stalking that's occurred in your community? Just to get a feel for where they are. And then I'll also talk with them more about training and education. It's so important that leaders in faith communities know how to appropriately respond to domestic violence, how to first help and seek to protect the person who's been victimized, and then also how to hold accountable the one who has used violence. So the training and education piece is huge, but as I just mentioned, the next part is also creating a space for healing and support for those who have been victimized. That's such an important piece. The safety and protection of a victim, of a survivor of violence, has to be number one. And communities of faith can do a better job of creating that space. Also going into this quickly, accountability is holding accountable those who use violence. That's a huge piece as well. Communities of faith themselves, there's an accountability there. There's a responsibility to speak up and to speak out against this issue. And so that's one, and then that's a collective accountability, and then also individually, which can only happen if it's safe for the person who's been victimized. And then also the community partnerships. There have to be partnerships with faith communities have to be connected to domestic violence agencies in their area, family violence intervention programs or battery intervention programs, with their local criminal justice system, and also even connected with their local law enforcement. When there are more connections made, that makes the response and even addressing of violence much more effective, and for the communities of faith to know more about what's available, what help is available, because the message of ending violence can't just come from one space. It can't just come from a church. It can't just come from a court system. It has to come from the whole collective community. And so when communities come together and decide to end an issue and take a stance and have that be a part of a movement, that's when it ends. And so that's what Kindred Moxie works to do, is to specifically at this point engage communities of faith to be more involved in a coordinated community response.
That sounds absolutely wonderful and really important, because you're right. If you just have the policy without the support from the community, it doesn't work. If you just have somebody preaching or offering support in a congregation, but without the other practical help that women need, that's not enough either. But all together, it can actually make a difference. And that,
exactly.
And they're all connected. So one is direct service, one is, you know, counseling, and then you get to law enforcement, and then you actually get to policy. And I want to ask you a question about policy, because lots of times people think, well, what does that ever have to do with me? You know, there's this federal policy, has nothing to do with my life. And in particular, I want to ask you about the Affordable Care Act, which is also called Obamacare, which actually does make a huge difference in the lives of women. One of the provisions of Obamacare is a provision of providing health services just for women. And it's both preventive care, it's screening, it's contraceptives at no cost, coverage for contraceptives, and then also screenings for domestic violence. And starting in 2014, sometimes a woman who's been assaulted, that's a pre-existing condition, and it's hard for her to get insurance. But starting into 2014, insurance companies won't be able to deny women coverage because of that. So in your view or in your experience, how many people or women know about this, know about the current provisions that they can have access to and what's coming down the road? And if that number is small, how can we get the word out?
Yeah, from what I found, Sally, most women who don't already have access to good health care don't know about what's available. And so that's a big problem. And there definitely has to be more education coming from, of course, faith communities being more informed about how policies are shaping and speaking to how policies are shaping and impacting the lives of their parishioners. And also it can come from women's organizations, you know, that work directly and that serve women, that sororities, that community centers are well-informed and know about this issue and know about how the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare impacts positively the lives of women in regards to them having more access to reproductive health options. Of course, healthcare facilities, and I would also even add schools and places where, you know, there are working moms. You know, and that of course teachers know about it, that there, when there's PTA meetings, I mean, any space in which there will be women there, and especially those women who may not have access to the greatest of healthcare options, that they know about what is available. So all healthcare facilities naturally, and even court systems. You know, even I work in a local county court in Decatur, Georgia, in DeKalb County. And, you know, we see so many women who come in to prosecute their domestic violence cases, to file protective orders. So we have a tremendous amount of access. And of course, the agency I work with, we work directly with women. So it's our responsibility to impart this information, that women know about it. So if each, in each area in which women are present and are coming for help or are looking for information, we can offer that. So that's definitely, I think that's one of the ways that we can do that. And I would even love to see more prominent leaders and celebrities even, those who are activists in particular, to talk about or to, you know, in some way to use their platform to spread the word, because they can make such an impact and such a difference just by saying something, you know, about this, because they have such a captive audience. So those are some of the ways that I recommend. And I think one of the last things I jotted down as a note is for what I found is that one of the ultimate forms of healing is for a survivor is when she becomes an advocate.
Oh, yeah.
And so that when she's, you know, involved in doing the work of impacting policies, or she becomes an advocate herself, that she's still operating and still still in the form of healing, still in the space of healing, but yet making an impact. And so I think that's another way in which, you know, other organizations and those that do advocacy work and policy work can further engage survivors to even be active, you know, when they're ready to, in the space of an advocacy, of an advocate rather, themselves.
That's a really important point, Victoria, because it's healing for the woman. But what that advocacy also does is for the public at large is it changes the face of who a survivor is of yes. domestic violence, because all yes. too often there are the notions, the stereotypes don't really bear much relationship to reality because there's so much secrecy about it. And so yes. if you see a woman who has five children, someone might be judgmental versus exactly. understanding what's going on. Exactly. A woman who has some prominence might be afraid to say something. A woman who's in the criminal justice system, we don't know how she got there or what those reasons are. And so these are really complex stories, and you're absolutely right. We have to break the silence, and it's, you know, for survivors to become advocates and to speak out is an important way to do that.
Definitely. I've attended, there's one thing I want to say. Two candlelight vigils for survivors and victims of violence in the past 2 weeks.
Wow.
And
wow.
the most important part of that,
yeah.
One of the most memorable parts, of course, is when we have survivors come and share their story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate to attend one, and I play an African drum, and the group that I drum with,
oh, wow.
we drum together.
Wow.
And most of the groupers are all men, and so it was one of the first times that they heard stories of survivors and the impact that it's had on them and the conversations that we've had on them. That vigil has created some more allies, some more men allies in doing
wow.
this work and
wow.
in this movement. So, you know, there are so many ways in which we can touch lives. And in which, you know, what people can be engaged in holding and hosting community events, things like that, make a tremendous impact in doing so. Because as much as important, of course, as it is and paramount for survivors to have a space to share their story, it's also so important that men are also allies and advocates in this movement, and that they're speaking up and that they're speaking out and that they're holding other men accountable who use violence, too.
I was just going to say that. I'm so glad you raised that. So it's not a male versus female kind of thing, but it's so important to have men allies, and there are. And
yeah.
so it's important to raise that issue, too, because, you know, so many men are troubled by that, by their sisters, their daughters, and what they see.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I want to ask you, I have one last question for you, and it is about the work that you do, which is really challenging work. And so every day you get up and you face your day, and I imagine many of those days are hard in a variety of ways. So what gives you the energy that gets you through the day? And if you want to even ask for a little bit more than energy, if there are glimmers of hope or big, bright, shining beams of hope every now and then, what gives you that?
Well, thank you for asking that. There's several things that give me energy. I think, first and foremost, I truly feel called by God, by the divine, into this work. As a minister, I have just always sensed a huge part of the work I've been called to do surrounding healing. And so that's what I see this as ways to just create safer communities for women and girls and to truly end violence, to just have true equality and love in our communities. But then also I'm energized by the survivors that I meet and talk to. I am still fortunate to facilitate a support group at the Women's Resource Center Safe House. And each week I hear stories of, you know, from these women that have endured, and it just amazes me that they're able to even share what they've experienced. And so I get energized and compelled and feel very responsible to just do the best work that I can when I hear those stories and when I meet with amazing survivors and children as well. And one of the other things that truly energizes me is talking and engaging with other leaders who are involved in doing social change work. You know, to hear and to listen to and strategize with others is very energizing to me. I get really motivated in thinking about how can we make more of an impact, you know, and hearing like what has been successful for you or what things have you done or what hasn't worked for you. And let me share with you some of my experience. For me, that really, that provides emotional support for me. And then also, you know, just intellectual stimulation. How can we do a better job of this? Because it's easy to feel is like overwhelmed and, you know, is this making a difference? Oh my goodness, you know, I've been
right.
doing this for this
yeah.
long.
Yeah.
So when I hear that, and of course also when I meet with a survivor, and now that I do work with typically men who have been who use violence as a compliance officer, even seeing a shift in their life and seeing a shift in the life of a survivor is very, very fulfilling. To meet someone who with a respondent of a protective order that has to be a part of a 6-month intervention program, and to see where they've started and where they finish can be very fulfilling, and it can be energizing to think like, okay, I can see that there's being impact made here. And of course, with a survivor that has been in such a difficult place, but yet has just overcome so many obstacles and has gone from truly, you know, really feeling like a victim to being more than a survivor, but even someone that's thriving. And that's so empowering too when that does happen. So those are some of the things that energize me. And what gives me hope is to know that there's an impact being made, to know that lives are being touched, to have the opportunity to plant seeds. What I've learned in doing this work is you can't really gauge success in numbers if you work for a business or a corporation of some sort, because you don't always get to see the immediate impact. It takes time in social change work. And so I truly get hope from the opportunity to share my experience, to share a word with someone, to have a conversation with someone about this work, to engage someone about their own experience and about how we can each be an ally and the impact that each person can make. So I get hope from the ability to plant seeds in different spaces and love to speak up and speak out about this issue and about domestic violence and reproductive justice. And sometimes it's not always well received, but I recognize that, you know, it's a part of who I am as well. And so I get hope from the opportunity to engage others, and I get hope from seeing impact that's made. And like I said, I also get hope and energize from the opportunity to think about it, to strategize about new ways to be more effective in this work.
I really like your phrase of planting the seeds, because as you know, if you plant seeds and then you go out the next day, you can't see them. It takes a while for them to grow. And the truth is, not every seed that you plant grows, but you'll never get a garden unless you plant the seeds. You have to plant seeds. And over time, you can see the change. It's slow, but you can see it. But you have to do the work. You have to plant the seeds. And that's what you're doing.
Definitely. And I thank you so much for the opportunity to do this work, more so with the Center for American Progress as a part of the Faith and Reproductive Leadership Institute, and just to in creating a space to be more informed and even just appreciated and to really think about and to have the space to strategize and think about how we can improve in this work. So I want to thank you at CAP and you especially too, Sally.
Well, we are so grateful to have you with us, and we just admire your work so much. It's amazing, amazing work. And so thanks so much for talking to us today. I think a lot of people will be really interested and inspired by hearing what you have to say. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, thank you. And I hope that for one last thing for
Communities
of Faith that and even with Kindred Moxie, how important it is to speak up and to speak out. I talked about several different methods and several different parts of the initiative, but speaking up, speaking out is so important. You know, what you preach about, what you talk about, what you say, period, what we put into the universe, what we say to others, it truly makes an impact. And so this my last point is that each of us and that those listening and that those reading will recognize that your voice truly makes an impact. That when you speak up and when you are a true ally in a movement, you make an impact. You make a difference. And I just want to encourage each of us doing this and each person that's interested in this work to know that you make a difference just by speaking up, just by doing it, just by being present.
I say amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sally.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh,
okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.